help on the general picture. The thing that I notice the most, of course, is really this smoking on the street. There is one great improvement, by the way, in my youth. Men especially spit on the street. You never could walk in San Francisco without holding your skirt up. I got to Providence when I was 9, and there were signs saying, do not spit on the sidewalks. But I don't remember what it said for sanitary reasons. And all these hotels had big polished brass spittoons. And of course women had brush braids on their skirts, and their skirt just barely cleared the sidewalk. I never had them quite as long. But this change in the spitting habits of the country is quite marked. Now, I don't know whether women were responsible or whether the health departments and so on, I don't really know what caused that change. But instead of setting a good example, women seem to have fallen for all the worst things that men did, except the spitting. They don't do much of that. In other words, this smoking on the street. And there was an old saying that no French woman left to go out of doors without having her gloves already on. The American put her gloves on as she went out in the street, and I suppose the less well brought up didn't wear them at all. I don't know. But of course, this hatlessness is a modern thing. You practically don't see, very seldom see any hats in the summer at least. And of course, I think this is a change. There seems to be much more drinking now than there used to be. I know I'm visiting Nora Barney. Her son John was a captain and used to go out with these charter parties a lot. And he'd been off with these two, I suppose, very rich young chaps on a boat on the Somme. And they stopped for supper at the Barneys. I noticed that they were a little bit high, and I spoke of it to Nora. Oh, yes, she says, the people who aren't intellectual drink is because it gives them a certain courage to talk. But she said the brainier people don't. Oh, I thought this was a pretty sad state of affairs. If you were so tongue-tied socially, you had to drink to feel able to express yourself. But this was her summary. I don't know whether it's correct or not. I never saw this with my children's friends here in the West, but in the East there seemed to be an awful lot of drinking. Maybe it was the boating set. There again, I haven't enough experience to know. But when I lived in Italy, you never saw anybody who drank too much. They grew up on these light wines. And in Providence, the idea of wine was whiskey or rum or brandy or something, champagne, something strong. But light wines, they never touched. And of course, in Italy, if a baby was anemic, they bathed it in red wine because they thought the iron in the wine was going to be helpful. And even little children were allowed a certain amount of, not enough to get intoxicated, but a little bit of red wine or red wine and water was supposed to be good for them. They certainly throve on it.
So the changes that you see are changes that have occurred for both men and women then?
Yes, I think so. There again, look at this pizza business in this country. It simply amazes me. I never saw or heard of a pizza in Naples, in Rome, in Florence, in small towns. Never. I think it must be a specialty of Sicily.
I think it is.
But I've eaten in small restaurants and big restaurants and all these small towns as well as cities. Never a pizza. And I hear that some of the Americans go over to Rome and are perfectly astonished that they can't get pizzas. And this, I think, is funny that such a such a sudden spread, and I wonder whether all the cooking has changed. I'm constantly so surprised. I order a spaghetti and it's just dripping with sauce. Terrible sauce. Well, in Italy, you always can wind it up with cheese, and there's never anything left. They put just enough sauce so that when you stir it up, it clings to all of it. But, and I, of course, I haven't been in Italy since 1911, and I wonder if all the cooking has changed that way. Become Americanized to suit the foreigners that come over and say, oh, this is not enough sauce. I'd give something to know.
Are there any jobs that women now have or careers they now have that you didn't see when you were a young woman as being available?
Well, when I first came back to America, I don't think women were anything but sales ladies or a telephone exchange or seamstresses. I can't think of any. Oh, secretaries, typewriters, of course, lots of typists. The clerks, I don't remember. Well, of course, there were all those blessed sweatshop workers who took work home under unsanitary conditions.
You don't recall women in the professions at all?
You mean personally?
Who were lawyers or doctors?
Well, I had a woman lawyer when I went to settle my stepmother's will in 1935, and I think she'd been a lawyer. She was in partnership with the person I thought was going to be my lawyer, and she had been a lawyer since... Well, I guess, any rate, 1925, that's the only lawyer I know. Then the Barringers, Dr. Barringer, the woman doctor, and her brothers were doctors, and then there was the one whose life I read. She and her husband were both doctors, and there's... And was the life by her? It was an autobiography. I don't remember. My mother went to her at one time because she always felt that her brain had been crippled by her nervous prostration, and it didn't satisfy her at all that she had more brains anyhow than most people, because she felt she wasn't at her best. Doctor had her doing all kinds of queer things, supposed to be good for the brain. Something to do with picking up blocks, and perfectly ridiculous from my point of view. What earth was her name? She was quite well known, and her husband, one of the early women physicians. There was another fine one in Providence that everybody respected, I mean other doctors in the profession. Well, that was way back in before 1900. Well, I can't think what her name was either. And I believe I was brought into the world by a woman doctor too. And Dr. Ting, you know, was she Ting? She was an early, I think, Providence doctor, and she adopted a poor little boy that was found tied to a chair in the slums while his mother was working. And I remember we had them Thanksgiving here at Pasadena, and I had to play with this small boy who was far from normal mentally. I mean, he was retarded. Bigger than I, and I found this was a very great hardship and boring for Thanksgiving to have to entertain this, or try to entertain this child. I still don't remember this this woman who had such a fine record. She was in New York.
Going back to the earlier suffrage period, do you were you involved in any of the other demonstrations besides that big parade?
Well, that's the only one I took part in. I think there was something and was pulled off in Washington, but I wasn't in it. I don't remember about it.
You weren't involved in the picketing of the White House in Washington at all?
No, I think that's the only, being a page for that first Congress in San Francisco.
When was that Congress?
That would have been about 1885, 92 or 3 or 4.
So you were just 8 years old or so?
It was, you see, I have to measure, I lived in Oakland between, I had my 7th and 9th birthdays in Oakland. Now just when in that period I can't say, and all my mother's letters and circulars and things about that have gone to the Schlesinger. So I really don't know, except somewhere between 3 and 9 that I was a page. And there was a platform, my mother was on it, and this seemed like an enormous theater where that Congress was held. It probably wasn't so enormous, but I felt very important going up down the aisles, and I had a gorgeous time licking the envelopes when my mother was sending out announcements. They had good tasting gum in those days, and licking the postage stamps. That was great satisfaction. And then we were invited by Sutro at the Cliff House, which he had out there for breakfast at about, I suppose it was a 10 or 11 o'clock so-called breakfast. And to my mother's horror, I was put way off to one side of the table, and she, of course, was at the head. And she watched me when they passed cheese, because there was Limburger on it, and she wondered what I was going to do. I took a piece of Limburger, and my mother kept her eye on me in dread. I got it up near my mouth, and I got one whiff of it, and I laid it down again. She was enormously relieved. I don't know what she thought I'd do. And that's all I remember about that fancy breakfast, was that cheese that I didn't eat. But it was impressive, great big table, you know, important people around it. I was the only child. But there was good excuses. I'd been useful in the performance. Also, my mother probably wouldn't have gone without me or had anybody leave me with or something.
Do you remember anything about the convention itself?
I don't remember a thing except running down the aisles with messages and hearing the people speaking on the platform. What they said didn't make any impression. These later things in the Cooper Union in New York, I remember the beautiful Mrs. Snowden speaking, but there again, what she said, and Mrs. Blatch, who's always had a beautiful voice, rich, melodious, and a fine presence on a platform, but what her arguments were, and what, I don't know. I suppose I didn't pay much attention, thinking all these things were proper and right. Or maybe I wouldn't have had that kind of a mind. I wouldn't have kept the thoughts. But this Summerbrook business was, that was really interesting. I was 16, or was I 17? I think I was 16 the first year that I went there. And here were all these strange people. There was somebody who was an ardent single taxer, and Clarence Darrow, the famous Chicago lawyer, and some dear ladies from Concord, Massachusetts, and a very haughty Prussian officer. I can't think what his name was. And Edwin Markham. I wish you could have seen Edwin Markham when it came to his, he drew the lot of wiping dishes, and we have these blue plates, and he'd take three of those, and he'd go over to this dishwashing business, all these laundry and so forth was a sort of a branch of this log cabin, and there was a half door and a lovely view of the mountains, and he'd go stand there and very slowly wipe this plate and wipe another, and while the rest of us would do almost the whole thing, while he did about three plates. And the second year that I was there, I'd been sick and wasn't to climb mountains, so I had the nice job of taking care of our stuff, and you see that he was fed and harnessed, but I had the less nice job of taking Mr. Markham around in this little cart, and I didn't like sitting up next to a man anyhow, so I'd have to drive sitting way over on one side. Mr. Markham was rather heavy at that time. He filled the other side. And then there was a nice man from Noyes, I think his name was Noyes, from Horace Mann's school. And out on this porch where we had breakfast, we had these shaker chairs that you're probably not familiar with, but stop in the small of your back. So there's no good, I suppose they didn't want you to lean back. And they had splint seats, and a lot of the seats had given way. So Mr. Noyes and I went clear across the valley to where there was an Indian who had these logs, and while we waited, he made the splint. He cut two little places, and then he began pounding, and this raised this whole piece. So we came back with that. Mr. Noyes taught me how to seat the chairs, and we had a great time fixing up the broken chairs. Also, I acquired sweetgrass that same way from the Indians in the valley.
What was that?
Keene is New Hampshire. Is it Keene, New York also? There's a fashionable section down in the valley. This place of Prestonia and Ann Martin's was up on the hillside, and the whole thing's built out of these enormous logs. And it had a window seat, a wide window seat, and a long window, and a beautiful view of Marcy and Whiteface, the two great Adirondack peaks.
Now, was this a summer conference that would happen every year?
No, Mrs. Martin invited who she wanted up there, and she liked all kinds of people. Another very trying feature was that she would read something before dinner or before supper, and this was supposed to be helpful in giving a start off the things to discuss. And one year it was the Bible, and another year it was Plato, I think. Plato's Republic. And so then the minute she was through reading this part, people would all begin discussing. Well, what I hated was I had a good appetite, and I'd see these piles of bread and pitchers of milk, and I was hungry. And I'd have to sit there and listen to Aristophanes or something, or the Bible. And you can imagine with single taxes, all these people with such different, the Prussian officer, all these different divergent ideas, it was a very mixed lot. The Prussian officer was very scornful of these people. He said they were vegetarians, and just look at their complexions.
And your mother was invited every year?
Yes. Those years, I think she'd been there before, and it was a beautiful place, and beautiful scenery, and lovely walks, and Hurricane was the town. Silly that I'm not so sure whether it's fashionable down below in the valley. It was a very fashionable section. It was 20 miles from Westport, and the first time I went there when I was 16. I had a little bit of a trunk, and I'd been in this girl's camp in the White Mountains, and I took a train north and then had to cross by ferry to Westport, and I didn't realize that when I left the train I should have rechecked my trunk. I sort of thought it would automatically be in this place and then I would check it, and they said, oh no, you should have done that before you left. So they said, give us your receipt and we'll gather it up and send it over in the boat tomorrow morning. This was the last boat. I got to Westport and my stepfather, who was a good deal of tea, said, that's the last you'll see of that truck. Well, we spent the night, and the next morning we went down for the arrival of that great, what seemed a great big boat, came across Lake Champlain and docked. And two men left the boat with my little bit of a trunk. It's the only thing, no passengers or anything got off there. So then we had this 20-mile drive to Hurricane. And,
did the gathering go on all summer long, or was it just...
The boat went on, I suppose, up Lake Champlain.
No, the group of people who were at this farm, was this...
Well, they were different every year. Whoever, I don't mean that there was a complete change, but whoever Prestonia Ann Martin thought should be invited got invited. It was her private enterprise. And I think it was an imitation of Brook Farm, but I don't think it's complete because there were only certain things that people took part in. John Phelps Graham Stokes was there, too. He was very tall, distinguished-looking, fine Connecticut family, and I had the privilege of ironing his handkerchiefs because my mother felt I could manage that. He had gorgeous, beautiful initial handkerchiefs. I ironed lots of those. And the washing machines were tubs with a cover and then a handle. She fixed up verses to go with that. 150 double strokes was supposed to be enough for your washing. Then they had to be hung on the line. Oh, and then Dr. Murray of Canada, I believe he was a Greek, a great Greek scholar. Evidently everybody thought was had a great feeling of respect for Dr. Murray. And so a pageant was gotten up for his benefit. And I guess to please Prestonia Man Martin. And we all got fixed up in Greek costumes, which were nothing, of course, but sheets, great. And we got birch bark, great, a piece this wide and about that long from big trees. And then we had the chorus, which my mother composed. And we were, I sent these things on to Cambridge again. I don't think I had the whole of it, only the things that I was to come in on. I think it was that way with all of them. So we had this Greek processional and chorus and so forth off in honor of Dr. Murray. It went off very well. I suppose he was gratified that we took the pains of it.
Were there a lot of other women there, like your mother, who were active in the feminist fight?
I was trying to think about the women and the thing. I remember those two nice Concord ladies that I went to see afterwards. I don't remember very many women, though Mrs. Markham, of course, with her son Virgil, they were there. And when Edwin Markham was entertained here in Pasadena by our assemblywoman, and all Pasadena was invited, I felt it was up to me to take my... I'd always been, or at least my stepmother and my mother, taking great pains always that I should meet people that were somebody. So I took my two children over to this assemblywoman's house, and presently Mr. Markham arrived. And he got out of this car and he spotted someone and he, oh, come to my flaming heart. Oh, I thought this is a funny beginning for the children. impression that these poets are like this. I don't know, I suppose he'd gotten a little old or something. I don't remember anything more about it except that I was so astonished at this thing. That's the last, I think his wife had died by that time. What's become of Virgil, I don't know. But my mother had known him in the early days in San Francisco, and she was being very careful as to who she went around with on account of her efforts to get a divorce. It wouldn't do to look as if he were too intimate with some other man. I also was taken to see Joaquin Miller, who was in bed at the time, and my mother was quite disgusted with him because he had cigarettes all over the floor, and in her diaries I found she spoke of him as a dirty old man. Didn't appreciate this need of smoking on the get up.
Can you recall when you first came to Pasadena? You voted that first year you came out here then?
Oh no, we didn't have suffrage that first year. I think it was 2 or 3 years later.
Well, because California had suffrage in 1912, I think, didn't they?
Well, you see, I came in 1912. Well, I couldn't have voted the first year. I think you had to be here at least a year before you could vote.
But that was the first time you ever voted, was out here. Do you remember how you felt about it at all?
Only a sense of there's one more thing to have to think about. I still find it so, with all these propositions and things. I believe in it highly, but I think it's an awful chore, especially now at my present age. I find it very hard to, you read an argument for and you read an argument against, and to make up your mind and to remember how you've made up your mind is, I think, a lot of work. Perhaps it's easy for you because you're young and could keep these arguments clearly in your mind, but
I think they're pretty confusing.
But I have to work with them and mark up a ballot to take with me, and then I don't feel dead sure I voted right, because the way these things are worded, a thing that may seem very worthwhile is bad because it's badly put together.
But you don't remember any sense of excitement or anything when you
voted? We had one of these machines that first time I voted, I think. And that was a little confusing and interesting. I took the census in New York for a war census in the Czechoslovakian quarter of New York. And you had all these questions to read to people, and then one of them was, do you own any mules? And on the east side of New York, of course, you didn't, and most of the people couldn't see any sense in that census. And I don't know that it really amounted to anything. So many things they did, and this last war, when they took the spare tire from our Lincoln, his old Lincoln Phaeton had a tire on each side, and we weren't allowed but one spare, which spoiled the looks of the car. But I doubt if they ever did anything with those tires. They were just laying in extra rubber, thinking they might be needed, I suppose. There's been so such a terrific lot of bungling. It's the old army thing, hurry up and wait. We'd get to a place and then nothing had happened. No, as far as I can see, there's been no change except that women have taken over a lot of men's vices, and that they do have more sense of responsibility than they did, I think. Of course, they should. But having grown up, poor people believed in these things, it didn't seem like much of a change to me.
Did you ever encounter difficulties as a child because of your mother's beliefs?
Not that I know of. If so, it must have gone over my head.
Because you must have been different from other children as a result of your background.
Well, I know that I was said to shed tears when my mother brought home a ferris waist. You probably never heard of ferris waist. Well, they were muslin underwaists for children, and they had horn buttons that were sewed on with tape, so they're quite long. You could put various things on the buttons. And she produced this, and I wept, and she wondered what the matter was. I said, well, I told the girls I didn't believe in these because they were, you know, they had fortified extra sewing so as to be able to hold. They weren't bone, they weren't corsets in any way, but of course, having heard about the evils of corsets, I felt that these things were reinforced. Well, my mother said, of course, if this was against my principles, that was that. Later I had them. I don't know whether I succumbed or I don't remember that. I only remember that she once suspected if I had an opinion and a reason for it. All right. Later I saw that they really had their good points, that they were easy to button and you could put your panties and your petticoats if you wore them. I didn't wear petticoats except in a long party dress or something. I grew up with matching little bloomers with my dresses. My mother feeling that one looked more respectable that way.
Was that different from the dress that other children had?
Oh,
at the time?
Yes, they wore white panties with lace and petticoats with lace or a handbag trimming. So I dressed rather simply and sensibly, and I was very hard on clothes. We were not well off. This was later. And my stepmother said, no, I don't want to in any way hinder your play, but 10 dresses to send to the laundry in 1 week is quite an item. And I think you'll have to have a little denim play suit, knickerbockers and blouse. I was delighted, of course. So from then on, I had knickerbockers and blouse. And of course, went barefooted. I could go barefooted all I liked, but I must wash my feet in the summertime if I came to table with bare feet. I couldn't come in the house all at the table with dirty feet. Just like my hands, they must be clean. Well, all this seemed to me eminently sensible. I mean, just didn't hamper my good times, and I could see the point. And these points never need arguing, because when I was 5, I developed a most inconvenient habit of saying that my mother wanted to see Gay Shanny. That was Grace Shanny. I called her Gay Shanny. Or Aunt Augusta wanted to see my mother or something, and had them running around the neighborhood. So I was told the wolf story, and that they were sorry, but they just couldn't believe what I said. I was under 5 at this time, I think. So then I'd be telling something at that table, you know, and they'd listen politely, but that was all there was to it. Finally, one day I broke down and wept, but I said, 'Tis true, too true, something disadvantageous to myself. And they said, well, only if you've learned the lesson, well, we'll believe you. Well, it made no impression on me. But it cured me absolutely. I mean, I only heard this afterwards. It didn't hurt. It was logical, you see. I'd been warned. So that was always the bringing up that I had, was to show me the reasons for things.
Was your dress very different? Did any other girls wear bloomers at this time, or the knickerbockers?
I don't remember any.
Did you have any troubles because of it? Because of your dress?
In fact, I would have gone about much more so. I mean, according to my stepmother, if I hadn't objected, we'd buy pongee by the piece. You know, the ends of it had delicious dull blue threads through it, and then a fringe, and I suppose The piece was perhaps 20 yards long or something, and it wasn't expensive. And I had bloomers, and by bloomers they were knickerbockers, they're not full things, and a waist all in one piece with a back that let down, of course. And then I had a skirt that buttoned, I guess buttoned onto that, because I certainly didn't have any other waist. And then a blouse with an elastic at the bottom and a sailor collar, and using this blue for the cuffs and the sailor collar. And my stepmother didn't see any reason I shouldn't go without the skirt bicycling, but I didn't feel that was quite the thing. So I stuck my skirt when I went downtown and so on. I don't know exactly why, because you'd think I would have felt this was better. But for years and years, I wore nothing but pongee underwear. It was so delightful. You could rinse it out so easily and so easy to iron. And when I visited up Keene Valley, it was Keene, visited Ellen Leach, she had knickerbockers of pongee, but they always came out stiff. And I said, well, your laundress is probably ironing them wet, damp, and it should always be ironed dry. So that cured that, but she found they were kind of unpleasant once washed. It was stiffness.
Was your stepmother also involved in the women's struggle?
Oh, yes. She taught the first free kindergarten in Providence, Rhode Island. And she was often the one that started my mother off. They'd go to a play, and it was she who'd write the first letter of shock over the disloyalty as in this play of the sister of one of the soldiers, where it was typical at that period that the women stood by the cause and didn't let their heart affairs interfere. In other words, there was a lack of loyalty shown. So my stepmother wrote long letters to the press, and they were answered by the writer of the play. Then my mother took up the cudgels. Then when the dead came back from Veracruz, it was my stepmother who wrote first, of her shock that here were these, was it 19 coffins going by on caissons with the soldiers riding the animals, you know. And she was horrified that these soldiers were chewing gum while they were in this procession. So she wrote about that. And then my mother took up the cudgels in the next tribune of the one after, and humorously about when she chewed gum at your grandmother's funeral and so forth. So they were always pitching in, but it was usually my stepmother was getting the first lexicon on these causes. Well, the Channings, of course, were all in on anti-slavery, and as I say, my stepmother was early in the... In fact, it was on account of her that they started the Society for the Protection of Children in Rhode Island. They had said it wasn't a bit necessary. You see, in this free kindergarten, they had these children of the very poor, and she had gone to see why one of her children had appeared in this, what they call, shoe fly village. And when she complained, and they said, oh, there hasn't ever been any need in the Society for Protection of Cruelty to Children, she told them this case, and these men were assigned to go and investigate with her. And they said to her, whatever you do, don't turn back. Don't act as if you knew that we're following you. It's as much as our lives are worth if you do. So that was the first time she'd ever felt nervous in going to that section before. But this was the cause of the founding of the society. It was her free kindergarten and her going into that shoe fly village. And there used to be a section in Los Angeles where we went in on the big cars with all these women early in the morning. I mean early, 10 or 11, and you'd go in town hanging out the windows and things, in still in their nightclothes, and iron marks on this, good penetrating tones, much to the amusement of the family, because this was a section of prostitutes at the time. And I couldn't understand why anybody was lolling around out of the window in a nightgown that hour of the day. Surprised me very much.
Now, your stepmother was
Grace Ellery Channing.
Now that was Stetson's, your father's...
She married my father.
She married your father. And she and your mother remained on good terms, though.
Good terms. They were the dearest of friends
all
their lives, yes. And then it was on account of the Channings that my mother first came to California. She came out and visited by herself and was apparently perfectly cured because she'd had a glorious time and was doing just what she felt like doing. I was in the hands of my grandmother. My father was in the hands of my grandmother, too, which wasn't blissful for him. And she was a dear lady, but because eggs were cheap, she decided that she ought to make pound cake just when butter was expensive and things like that, you know. She wasn't as economical as might be. And, but she was, my mother always said, was at her best with babies, so I was left at her, with her while my mother went to California and visited the, she must have stayed right with the Channings that time. And they were all these parties and things that she enjoyed and came back blooming on his world again under responsibilities and household. So then when my stepmother went east, she visited, she was staying in Bristol. My mother came down to be near her with me when I was around three. So the Channings were of the were ultra liberal in all ways. This Crofts case, Mrs. Freeman in New York has been has written a book about the Crofts, who are these two escaped slaves from the South who got as far as Boston and then were happily engaged and doing good work. They, when agents came up from the South to capture them, and at that time they were property and could be captured, and the city of Boston, especially the Unitarians and all the vigilante, they had an organization there that were helping escaped slaves, cornered these men. The man who'd been the informant and told a Southern agent and got them in a hotel, Dr. Channing was one of those. They were walking, Theodore Parker the other, and they were walking back and forth beside the door where these men were to see that they didn't escape. The crowd was ready to tear them to pieces, too. And they explained to the hotel foreman that they didn't dare to leave with that crowd outside. So finally they were smuggled out and the Crofts, I think it was then right after that, the Crofts went and stayed in somebody else's house, they were invited, and then they went up to Canada and over to England, and then finally came back and went to the South. But Dr. Channing was in on all those things, and my stepmother, before she was my stepmother, unveiled the Theodore Parker Monument in Florence, Italy, where I suppose he died and was buried there. This I'm not clear about. I'm sure it must have been his grave. And say the Channings were in all liberal movements, including William Ellery Channing, Dr. Channing's father, who was considered, of course, horribly broad-minded. He and my grandfather, Lyman Beecher thought William Ellery Channing was something terrible, and when he finally got a pulpit in Boston, he was just laying into William Ellery Channing. He believed, this great-grandfather of mine, in damnation, you know. It was quite different from William Ellery Channing.
Do you, are there other women in this area who your familiar with who were involved in some of the early suffrage struggles who are still
I'm
around?
I'm getting to be the last person alive. All my friends are dying. No, I don't think any of the early set is living. Because all the friends I had were always older than I. And